Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
To another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is filmmaker, animator, artist, musician, I think, Clive Peterson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
Now, I know it's an audio medium that we're talking on, but I know we were talking about where you are at the moment. Can you just describe where you are, the islands off Seattle that maybe are closer to Canada?
Yeah, right now I'm sitting in a wooden boat that's in the forest, not on the ocean.
Yeah.
And I'm about 20 miles south of Vancouver, BC, hoping the island breaks off from its footing and drifts into Canadian territory at any moment.
Escape the USA.
Yeah, that's the hope. But realistically, I'm about an hour and a half north of Seattle.
Now, we're here to talk about the documentary you've made about the band Earth, Even Hell Has Its Heroes. And then we're going to talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. But before we get into the three films, then let's start with the documentary. And I guess the best place to start is, where does a documentary about Earth begin? I've interviewed lots of people about music documentaries, and I can't believe how many of them start off with, I just had a camera and I started filming the band. And that became a documentary. So where does the documentary start for you?
I wish that the documentary had started with, I just had a camera. Let's see. I think in 2007, I met Earth for the first time through our mutual bandmate, Steve Moore. Mm-hmm. He plays trombone and keyboard in Earth and in my band, Your Heartbreaks. It was just before The Bees Made Honey and The Lion's Skull was coming out, and Steve had mentioned that they needed some help, some managerial help getting ready for touring.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, Randall Dunn had been doing that work, but it's a lot of work to like record, produce, tour manage, and manage a band. So he was kind of stepping away, and I had been touring and managing some other bands that Steve were in. And I was stepping away from those. So we kind of just did a little bit of a shuffle,
mm-hmm.
a Rubik's Cube move.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for Earth for 5 years as their manager.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great 5 years. We had a great run. I mean, from Bees Made Honey to Angels of Darkness, Demons of Light 2. We did a lot of work with Southern Lord. They toured a lot. They made 5 records, I believe, in that time. And they grew like exponentially in popularity to a point where like I was not necessarily like a good manager for them anymore. Like when I started working for them, they just like didn't have an email address. And I was like, well, surely I can make you an email address. Like they had a landline, would call them, leave long messages until they picked up, you know, like they were very much moving from like the analog world into like having email.
Yeah.
And that's stuff I know about. I'm not like a Los Angeles style manager. I don't have like huge connections. So after 5 years, it was kind of like mutually agreed that like they should go find a manager in Los Angeles to like continue to up their game, or you know, just have access to doing soundtracks and stuff like that.
Mm.
And I moved on to start making my first feature film. So in that time, I wish I had a camera and I wish I had been filming, but I was really busy working. You know, I was very busy like emailing and mailing merch and driving a van. So in the time that I made my first feature, Torrey Pines, Dylan and Adrian and some of the Earth crew did some of the soundtracking for that. And we all played the soundtrack live at the premiere in Seattle.
Oh, wow.
And it was like at that show that I had been kind of like gently asking Dylan, like, we should make a film, you know? It's like tender to ask someone to talk about their lives and open up. So it was at that screening that he was like, at the end of the movie, he's like, let's do it. Let's make a film. There was a point within that touring where Dylan got really sick. And a lot of us were like, he might die. Like, oh, this wow. is, this might be it. And, you know, he made it through. So that was a big, like, feeling of urgency, too. Like, I have this access and I have, like, a lot of deep knowledge of these night creatures. Like, I should see if they want to speak their truth or whatever. Like, I can turn on a camera. That's the long-winded way of saying I had a camera, but it took a long time to warm them up to being open to it because of previous experiences they'd had and had felt betrayed by.
So what I should say as well then is that Earth as a band are, I guess, one of the pioneers of what we now call drone rock. I mean, slow heavy metal is another description. Sludge and various other terms that people use. I've, as a fan, I've been listening since Earth 2. I remember reading a review that said, of Earth 2 in particular, that said, this is like flotation tank music, and immediately wanted to know what that will sound like. And it's pretty accurate, I think, if you listen to Earth 2. But, and then I think it was, what I found fascinating about them was the minimalism of it all. And then I think it was the fourth album where drums were included, and it felt like an orchestra compared to what I'd been used to. It's amazing how when a music is so minimal and so concentrated on just the drone. And I remember, I think it's on some of the documentary stuff that's with one of the album CDs, that Dylan talks about listening to finding your own modulation with oscillation, sorry, finding your own oscillations within the drone. So you tune in, which blew my mind completely, that I could be listening to something completely different to somebody else and it's the same tune.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about that a lot. Yeah.
I mean, there's another band there's a band called Godhead Silo. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
I do. Mike Kunkka.
And one of their records, they have an 11-minute one-note bass solo, which is quite the phenomenal thing, given it's only a 35-minute album. And when that starts, I always find myself going, oh, my goodness, I've got to brace myself now for an 11-minute one-note solo. And then partway through, it does that thing that Dylan talks about, which is I suddenly start to find the oscillations in it. I mean, it's just a repetitive thing. I mean, you're a musician, you know exactly what that must be, you know. And then at the end of it, I feel like I've achieved something. All I've done is listen to it.
Yeah. I love that band. And some of them, yeah, live out here in the Northwest in the forest too.
Yeah, I might. Well, yeah, I guess they're a sub-pop band, aren't they, I suppose? They were a sub-pop band back in when I was listening to them.
Yeah.
My digression aside there, I just thought I'd give some context for the listener about the music that you were covering, because I think the idea of a band becoming big is not unusual, but I think for music that's not necessarily embracing the mainstream in a sense, for them to grow to the need to have an LA manager, as you put it, makes it, you know, they're not Bruce Springsteen by any stretch of the imagination, are they, in terms of what they're making? It's a very atmospheric and almost like Is therapeutic the right word? It can be, I suppose. It can do that for you. What was the trust? What was the trust you had to convince them that you were going to do as a filmmaker? What did you say to gain that trust that they didn't have maybe of filmmaker full stop in the start?
We went into the film with this just handshake agreement that, like, I could film anything and ask anything, but they could cut anything.
Oh.
So there was, I mean, it's not necessarily a traditional documentary in that sense. Uh-huh. In the end, they did not cut anything, which, you know, it was like nerve-wracking to take it to the theater and sit with like 20 members of Earth and be like, here is what I made of your story. I hope you like it. I was like shaking halfway through the screening, just like I couldn't stop shaking. And at the end, they were just like, we love it. It's like,
oh my word.
Because I was very worried.
I could imagine.
Yeah, so that was just the agreement. Like, I, you know, there are like moments of talking about grief in the film, and that was like really, really worked up to that.
Hmm.
And like worked up to like providing a really like gentle space for like Dylan to talk about grief and let it out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And with the, you know, obvious rule that like he can cut it if he doesn't want it in there. So yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Because I guess it's freedom to do what you want, but obviously there's not pressure on them to accept everything you're doing, which is, I guess, is a kind of, it creates its own trust then, because you can, you're not scared of saying anything because you can say anything. And at the same time, you're not scared to ask anything because they can remove it if they're not comfortable.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of documentaries that are like very, you know, exploitation centered, whether they want to admit it or not, right? Like,
yeah,
documentary as a film sport is like vaguely exploitation narrative a lot. And like when I, in approaching this film, like I just wanted them to be able to tell their own story.
Mm.
Like how they saw themselves. Like I didn't want the film to be like how I saw them. I just wanted them to like talk about their lives and just capture that a little bit, you know?
I was watching an interview with Errol Morris talking about Gates of Heaven. And in that he says, you investigate, you look, you think, you study in the hope that you can learn something about the world. So if what did you learn? I mean, having worked with Earth, you obviously knew them. And that 5 years is a long time to get to know anybody, never mind work with them. So what did you learn about Earth's world from making the film?
Well, I think it's funny. I try not to like read film reviews. I dash in once in a while and look at them to just see what people are thinking, but they really stick in my mind in a bad way. So, but someone wrote in a review, like, we don't really learn about Dylan. And I'm like, there's nothing to learn. Like, he is a guitar player. Like, I'm just showing you what he does in the movie. Like, if you want me to film him watching the History Channel, I could. But like, he really does like sleep, eat, and breathe guitar.
Mm.
And I think like there is this expectation that like when you watch a documentary that someone's going to spoon feed you these little facts about someone's life. And I didn't do too much spoon feeding, but I really do feel like I just filmed what was.
Mm.
I didn't get a chance to go film the D&D game that I wanted to film, you know, like I would have loved to film Earth's Dungeons and Dragons game.
Mm.
But, you know, I what I learned is that they love playing music, and I kind of already knew that, but
yeah,
they are like very like front facing people. They're not really hiding much. And I don't know. I think that's just like such a strange thing to request and demand in a film. Tell me everything. I don't know. I don't think you want to know everything.
Oh God, no. But is it? But you in a kind of privileged position from an ordinary documentary filmmaker that would have been perhaps helicoptered in at the same point in their career? Because, like you said, I wish we had filmed stuff you knew there'd been moments that could have been interesting for a documentary. You know, going on tour, for example, would have, I guess, as a tour manager, there's lots of tales of what that might have been able to dredge up or not, you know, in terms of showing us who right. the band are.
To be very honest, tour is so boring. Like, you're just driving. And Earth tours, somehow the drives become twice as long. I think it's the cigarette breaks. Like, you just wake up and you go to Starbucks. Like, that's what they want for breakfast. And then you drive for like 9 hours, even though it's like a 4-hour drive. And you're like, how did this drive become so long? And then there's like a bunch of cigarette stops, and then you load in and you play a show and you go to sleep. Like, that's an Earth tour. Mm. Once in a while, there's like a little hijinks, but like, it's very, very dull.
What do you think either you or they put down this kind of change in popularity? I mean, what do you think is, I mean, the music has developed, the music has matured. I wouldn't say it's better, and I wouldn't say one's worse than the other. It's an evolution of a band, isn't it? But what is it in the water that they think is making them be, you know, play those bigger venues, you know, more sustainable touring than they would have been used to? Because we're still not talking stadium rock or anything. It's just more sustainable than it was, I'm guessing, before, when they would have toured and they could have maybe broke even. And if they did a lot of merch, that'd have been a good, you know, they'd have been a good tour kind of thing.
For Earth, it feels just cumulative, like the playing the long game. Mm. You know, you just keep going. More people hear about your band. It certainly isn't like stadium selling, as you say, but I think one thing that all of us see in the audiences is like this strange, like, cross sections of all kinds of people, like jazz nerds, computer programmers, metal heads. They kind of like have this very abstract draw that I don't see for very many bands. And I think it's like a superpower to be able to speak to so many different people. And as you say, like, everyone's hearing a different thing. I have this thought that, like, we are living in a society that just is perpetually propelling us forward and demanding that we move faster and faster and faster.
Mm.
And that, like, Earth shows are a refuge for you to, like, slow down for a minute and not be asked to speed up at all. I think that that is something that audiences get from their live shows. I used to get it every night on tour. I would be like exhausted from driving and loading merch. And then they would start playing and I would just feel like this huge wash of relief on my body every night. And I'd be like, this is why we do it. So strange. Magical.
But it's weirdly, I mean, musically, they're nothing like them, but in many ways, when you're describing the audience there, it's like, you could have been describing like an audience for The Fall, you know, that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of, I guess what I'm saying is there's like an enigmatic attraction to what they're doing that is, I'm doing it anyway. You can come with me, but it ain't gonna change for you. But you can come along. I mean, you're very welcome.
I love that philosophy of life. That is one of my favorite. I'm gonna do it with or without you. Might as well enjoy the party. Come on. Yeah. I feel like The Fall definitely has like a similar draw, has had a similar draw.
Yeah.
Interest. Yeah.
And ironically, that idea of being able to switch off, and both bands have been prolific. I mean, Earth still are prolific in terms of their output. Certainly in the 21st century, they've certainly, you know, there's a lot of work out there for people to mine. And obviously that was a quality people associate with The Fall. You know, it's a very working class, almost like Protestant work ethic to like you say, for something that is also, hey, let's just settle, let's have a rest, let's indulge ourselves in this, which is kind of the opposite of that as well.
Yeah. I mean, Earth is a working class band. Mm. So like they have for most of their lives had jobs.
Mm.
Like Dylan worked at a picture frame shop for years. Adrian worked as a barista for years. Don McGreevy ran like a side mechanic shop in a garage while bartending nights. Like everyone has like 2 to 4 jobs in the band Earth. And it's like, they're just trying to get to the point where they can like just survive off their music, you know, as most bands are. But yeah, I think that working class ethic can easily transfer over to music if you're enjoying what you're doing.
Absolutely. When you were going through the process of shooting what you wanted because they knew they could cut what they wanted, what for you was the big discovery in the edit or big surprise for you in the edit? What did you get that you didn't see when you were shooting that you began to see come together when you were in the edit with it?
I felt like I walked away with like a time capsule. I entered the film process like attempting to interview every person that had ever played on Earth. A few people turned me down. I think something I learned from that is it like, not everyone wants to revisit the past. It's not always a fun place to go.
Yeah.
And that was definitely something I took away from that. Like, oh, you don't want to remember. I see. Okay, that's fine. Carry on. You know. I think, what else did I learn from it? I mean, it was such a long journey, 5 years.
But that process of editing is where you're trying to create the film then, aren't you? Because obviously you shoot and you get a lot more than you need, obviously.
Yeah.
So
we had like 40 hours of interviews.
Yeah. So how do you, what were you finding in that 40 hours interview did you feel the story emerging as you're shooting or did you find the story when you were editing?
I think both.
Okay.
The film was a little bit different in production than most films because it was shot on all Super 8, which doesn't contain audio. The structure of the film is a bit like a cake. So the bottom layer is all Super 8 film. No audio, no synced audio, no talking heads. No one is in the film being like, this band changed my life. You know. The second layer is basically an audio collage of interviews and,
oh, wow.
You know, that line up with different people. It is like presented a bit chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
We don't go album by album. We do kind of go like member by member throughout the timeline with a little bit of wiggling. And then there's a third layer, which is Earth came into the studio at Mel Detmer's and recorded a brand new soundtrack for the film. So they made 90 minutes of new music.
Wow.
And then the top layer, which is my favorite layer, is field recordings done by Mel Detmer.
Okay.
And so Mel spent like an extraordinary amount of time editing or cleaning up the audio from my messy audio and adding like this beautiful layer of like nature into the film. So that's kind of the structure of like the film you'll see.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a bit of an art film for sure.
No, that's good. No,
titles on.
I was going to say it sounds weirdly like. Are you familiar with the filmmaker Mark Jenkin, who did the film Bait and Enna's Men?
No, but I will.
Okay, so he'd shot on defunct black and white Super 8, all scratched up, and then home processed it. And then ADR'd the dialogue. So it's a feature film, not a documentary. And then he ADR'd the dialogue on after because it was quicker to shoot without syncing. And then it plays like almost like a spaghetti western because he isn't completely syncing it. But that becomes the style of the film. It's this because they're just two layers of the production.
Sounds amazing.
And it's beautiful. It was a beautiful, very, and equally, just with what you're saying there about the layers, in his second film, Enna's Men, which, I mean, Neon picked up. It's bonkers when you see the film. It's a pure art film. And it's just, it's a study of his wife. His wife plays his character who's taking these readings of plant life on a remote island. And all the foley layers in and the music that's scored to it is He's very, again, he shot it on color Super 8, I think this on maybe Super 16. And again, the sound is like the way you described it. It's a recipe or layers like substrata, rather than the idea of I'm capturing sound and audio. It's like I can build a better sound of what a crackling radio is after the event and just film a radio in the room. I'm looking forward. I mean, I'm more excited to see the film now, knowing that there's because it's very meta as well that they've made a score for the soundtrack of that's about them. That's lovely and meta as well, isn't it?
It was so fun. I mean, it was also like amazing that we did it that in 2019 and then COVID came, and like we would have been so much harder to do every single thing we did. So yeah, really snuck it in under the wire there.
Brilliant.
Each section about like the players in Earth, like that player was invited to come and score their own section too. So there's like all of this new Earth music, primarily by Dylan and Adrian as a duo with some overdubs, or like Bill Herzog would come and play bass. Mm.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Per day, and then like each section, like individuals were allowed or invited, not allowed, but invited to score their own stuff, which is so magical because then you get to hear their kind of like the music that makes their heart beat and like how it can enter into Earth's world, like, but them just solo, and so just like seeing what everyone would do every day was extremely wild. Like Bill Herzog just plays solo bass in the style of the Godhead Silo. So like for like 5 minutes, he just played the same riff over and over. And I was like, what is Bill doing? Then I listened to it later and I'm like, this is the most magical thing I've ever heard.
Wow.
And like Angelina Baldos came in with a like bucket of water, a trumpet and four pedals and made some like wildly experimental, beautiful music. So,
wow! It's like you've started a process off, and it's just mushroomed into different bits of its own. You could break down each one and have there's a piece of art of itself, and then you've wrangled it and made it into a. I mean, I've wrangled it makes it sound simpler than it probably was. It obviously was, but yeah, that's amazing.
It's really fun. I know it's like not a film for everyone, but I don't think any film is for everyone, and that's fine.
My own personal theory is if you look at, I mean, this is not, I want to advertise a big online superstore, but that, you know, the way that customers rate stuff, my theory is if it's rated 5-star by 25% of people and 1-star by 40% of people, I'm generally going to be all right with it. When I'm talking about films, obviously, not about everything, but like,
yeah.
I mean, about shower caps. I'm not going to use that theory for shower caps, am I? But if it's a film, and it was weird because two films that I love, Only God Forgives and Ridley Scott's The Counselor, have that profile. And I'm like, and that's my only anecdotal evidence. I mean, there's no proof of this, but it's my little, I kind of hold on to it now. I think It's almost like if people can love it and people can hate it, then I think it's doing something right. There's never room. There's enough room in the world for bloody stuff that's a bit meh. You know, we don't need more meh stuff in the world. Mm-hmm. We need stuff that's going to make us challenge what we think and challenge what we think about what we're watching. And it sounds like what you've made is going to give us that in buckets fulls. So I'm looking forward to it.
Definitely saw some people walk out of the theater at the premiere. I mean, happy to see it, honestly. They were like ready to acknowledge that that wasn't for them. And I was glad that they had boundaries. You know,
indeed.
You don't have to sit here for 2 hours. It might not be for you.
Well, look, thank you very much for sharing that about the film Even Hell Has Its Heroes. If I wasn't already excited, I am absolutely excited now, Clyde. You've absolutely whet my appetite for that film. Let us move on now to three films that have impacted everything in your adult life, which sounds more daunting than it is. It's more about memories and how films form us and that kind of thing. It's not the absolute building blocks, but I think having made a documentary like you have and been involved with a band for 5 years, and like I could say, like I was saying before, I got their first album. It's like I think art has a kind of tendency to personally biography us without us really realizing. And hopefully we can tap into some of that, talking about these three films that you've chosen. For the people tuning in for the first time, I'll just give the sort of rules, as it were. So Clyde is familiar with the rules, and so is the listener who's never listened to this before. I've got three films. We're going to talk about each film for 5 minutes. First off the block is, or the lot even, is 2012's Persistence of Vision, directed by Kevin Schreck. What is it about that film? Where are you in terms of, where do you see that for the first time? Why does it have impact on you?
I first saw Persistence of Vision in Seattle, Washington at the Grand Illusion Theater, one of the smallest and most wonderful theaters in the entire world. It seats about 40 people. A group of Seattle animators had gotten together to go see this film about Richard Williams, a master animator who is working on his masterpiece film. It's like the end all be all of his career. Mm. And he struggles for years to make this film. And it was a pleasure to watch it with so many animators. Mm. And the end results of the film is spoilers.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah. I think we can be safe with the 2012 film.
You know, Richard. Yeah. The end result of the documentary is like Richard Williams has a catastrophic loss of his film, and Disney buys what is left of his film and turns it into a musical. Mm. And it's a horror show of a documentary, kind of displaying like all the horrors of capitalism and the ways it can ravage an artist. Richard Williams was the animator for Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and he developed like a million amazing animation techniques. Yeah. The thing that happened after I saw this film is we all went out for a slice of pizza down the street. And as animators, you talk and you just chat about what you just saw and the horror show that has been laid before you. And I mean, for UK listeners, this took place in the UK too. So it's like, interestingly rooted in, I believe, in London. And another animator, Tess Martin, who lives in Europe these days, was like, would any of you guys try to make a feature film? And that was like a real moment for me when I was like, well, if this guy can try and fail, I certainly could try and fail. It was such a valuable lesson to watch like someone with extraordinary amounts of money and power try and fail, and to take away like that lesson is what I took away from that film. And it's just horrifying. The entire story is horrifying, and the documentary shows it quite well. And yeah, so that's what I loved about that.
It's interesting, isn't it, that a universal truth, and one that nobody really tries to teach you, is that the trying and failing is more common than the trying and succeeding in a way. It's not, that's not to put people off doing stuff, but everything we do, certainly in a creative pursuit, is a series of trial and errors and work in progress. And some of those work in progresses make it to something you call finished, and some wither on the vine, I suppose. I suppose this is a very dramatic version of how bad that can go. Unintentionally, I suppose. I mean, I don't suppose anyone set out to capture that story, but that's the story that the documentary captures.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so grateful to the person who made this film, because we're all raised in this like culture of hero worship, and like we only hear about the successes, and to see someone who is like such a famous animator just catastrophically fail, it's heartbreaking to sit and watch this film. But it also just sparked something in me that made it fine to like try and write a feature. And so my first feature is a stop motion animated feature film. It's called Torrey Pines, and it's an hour long. And basically immediately following that film screening, I went and started storyboarding and quit my job and did a Kickstarter. And it was like just this monumental moment.
No, that's amazing.
So glad. Yeah.
And what's the appeal in a digital age of stop motion?
I'm just such a sucker for the analog. And I think that's why Earth and I get along so well, is we love an answering machine. We love Super 8 film. We love a collage. You know, so it's just nice to go slow. It's nice to take your time. And even in animation, you constantly feel like you're rushing. So it's confusing.
Well, there's our first 5 minutes. Thank you for sharing that. I can't believe that. You're my first I think nearly 30 of these now, and you're my first to sort of, I saw a film, I made a film, stories. I've been hoping to get this story. I'm so glad I've got it, Clyde. Thank you. It was almost like I thought it was the obvious thing. I thought it'd be the obvious thing I'd get talking to filmmakers, that here's the film that made me make a film kind of thing, but that's amazing.
For sure.
Right then.
I feel like every artist should watch that film.
No, I totally agree. Yeah. Second off the lot is 1978, Gates of Heaven, a film that which I've already commented on from a kind of what Errol Morris was talking about. And I think it's a fascinating thing, because you were talking earlier about the idea of listening to the band as opposed to exploiting the band, and then seeing the truth emerge, because it's the only if you let them tell it, then that's what should emerge, as it were. Whereas I think there's always that problem, isn't there, with documentary filmmakers. If I point a camera this way, then I'm not showing you what's going on behind. So I'm only giving you a truth. There could be a massive fire behind me, but it won't matter, because I'm showing you somebody looking cool under pressure. You know, it's like it's weird, isn't it? The camera never lies, but it's a lying bastard at the same time, because it has a point of view. And if you can play with that point of view. Anyway, I'm rattling on. Why is Gates of Heaven?
I love it.
You're making me do it, Clyde. What is it about Gates of Heaven that has impact on you, the 1978 documentary by Errol Morris?
Let's see. I first saw Gates of Heaven probably from like a VHS tape. I was living in Bellingham, Washington, going to college, primarily studying bong hits and skipping class. And we had a local video store called Film is Truth, run by an extraordinary pair of highly opinionated people.
Right.
And they would never hire me. I was always like, here's my application. They'd be like, get out of here. We're not hiring you. But Gates of Heaven was something. I lived in a house with many filmmakers and artists, you know, just paying cheap rent and skipping class. And Gates of Heaven is something we watched together. And it just struck me that, like, I just remember watching it and thinking, you can make a film like this? This is absolutely baffling to me. And Errol Morris, I think I recently watched the same interview as you. You know, he's just like, starts the camera quietly. And a lot of people are very uncomfortable with silence. I am not one of those people. And so I could sit there quietly for a freaking hour. until the person in front of the camera cracks and they just start like spewing their truth. And I feel like that's what he did. I recently watched the interview with him about this film in which he talked about there being a newspaper strike that year and how, and the film, it was his first like feature and the film never got reviewed, but Siskel and Ebert reviewed it 5 times on TV.
Oh, wow.
On their show. Like they loved it. And so the film just like had a life of its own. And it really like kind of took off and made his career, like gave his career some momentum. But this film deeply influenced the Earth film. There is a scene where the one of the sons of the pet cemetery owners is playing guitar up on a hillside.
Right.
And he's just like this hippie. They have like, I think 3 kids. And there's a businessman who's trying to run the business. And there's this like hippie kid. And he takes his huge guitar amp up to the top of a hill and is just shredding the guitar. And it's echoing over the fields of this pet cemetery. And like, that is like my heart. Like that scene, it just struck me as something that was so like magical realism and beautiful and real at the same time. And I just like carried that through to the Earth film so many times. Like there's a scene in the Earth film where I make Jonas row a rowboat with oars made out of guitars. And that is a direct, like directly influenced by Gates of Heaven. So yeah, I love Errol Morris. I'll just sit in silence until people speak.
And is that also a technique of his? Is that something that he would do? I mean, as an interviewer, it's a game. There's a game going on when you're interviewing anyway. Always about and the amount of times I go in the edit and I find I've interrupted and I annoy myself to hell. But also there is those times when I can take a beat and it leads to another interesting revelation from the guest. I mean, it isn't natural to do it, and it isn't easy to do it, I don't think.
Yeah, just a bunch of interviews with him. He definitely speaks to that fact. He's a private investigator also, like, as a job to pay the rent. And so I think he is a deep listener, which is something, you know, a lot of Earth fans share, is, like, deep listening.
Yeah. I guess it, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? It's like
you
keep coming back to this thing about taking time out. It's like it's active what Errol's doing and what you were doing, but it's also a considerate way of taking time out. It's not just a wham bam thank you man, you know, for want of a better expression.
Yeah, I am a big fan of the long game. I don't really prefer short stories or short films. I just really like to like sit and get to know someone, read a deeply lengthy book, watch a really long film, and I appreciate that about Errol Morris. I think he points the camera at things that aren't necessarily highlighted in general in the world and just lets you like take the time to get to know them. He's very curious. He follows his curiosity, which I think is something that like a lot of adult people lose on their journey to adulthood, and then they just go in the same dog loops over and over. But if you just stay curious.
Yeah, no, that again, that was something I got from the interview with him, that just the notion of he read in a newspaper that there was a place for pets to go to heaven, and everyone was going there. He's like going, what, this exists? And that's the start of a documentary. Idea of that's where he started. It wasn't like he wasn't looking for a documentary. He's just reading. He's like, incredible that life is doing this already. Let me just go and have a look.
Absolutely. I think I just read some interview about John Waters in which he reads like 6 newspapers every morning too. I feel like people who read a lot are staying curious. So.
Well, I mean, what's he called? I remember reading something that Kubrick said about he never likes to search out what he's being told to search out. He loves the incremental discovery of, I find this that leads me to that, that gets me to this, because that becomes your own narrative then as well, because you're forming the linkages, which is then creating your own interest, isn't it? You know, there's no way I would have listened to Godhead Silo, for example.
Absolutely.
Without Earth, you know, before, you know, giving me the push up to say, you can go down here if you want. There's nothing to be afraid of.
You can do it. We know you can do it.
Right then, we're moving into your one and only feature film on the list. By Hook or By Crook, Silas Howard and Harry Dodge's 2001 film. Where do you see this for the first time, and who do you see it with, and why was this one a film that had impact on you, or how did it have impact on you? I must admit, this is a film I've not seen.
I must have seen it in Bellingham. By Hook or By Crook is a buddy tale of a road trip between two people going to San Francisco, each searching for themselves, and having a friendship along the way. There is a lot to be said about it. I saw it in Bellingham, probably in 2001, mm-hmm. and it came out. I've got it on DVD. It's scratched and worn and skips for sure. I'm a queer person. Mm. I'm a person who doesn't necessarily identify deeply with gender in any way. And this movie talks about that. And it's about two people who don't necessarily go by he or she pronouns. They're kind of gender is this ambiguous state in this film. And when people talk about representation mattering and seeing yourself on the screen, I saw this film and I was what's happening? That's me. I don't understand the world around me. I don't understand why people are so strongly into masculinity and femininity. And isn't there an in-between where we can just be humanity? And this film really speaks to that in a subtle way. It's not about that, but it is representation mattered. And when you're 20 years old and growing up in a small town and you see this movie, you're wait, something like me kind of exists. Maybe. I don't know what that is, but I'm going to find out more about it. This film was written by two people who were deeply involved in a writer's movement in San Francisco in the late 90s, early 2000s. There was a very strong scene of writers kind of collectively gathering and having a cafe scene.
Oh, wow.
And presenting work live, constantly. It was this huge movement of writing in America. And these two people, Silas Howard has gone on to become a television director, a film director, and many things. Mm. And Harry Dodge has gone on to become a modern artist in many ways.
Oh, wow.
So they're still living and working. And this movie has been compared to Jean Genet writing, or it's connected to a long lineage of people who aren't afraid to tell their truth, regardless of how the world might respond to it. And it's messy, and it's filmed on VHS and digital video in a time period where digital video doesn't look good, and it doesn't hold up. It was that real rough transition between VHS and digital, and it's probably 720 or whatever. It's just, you look at it now and you're Jesus, this looks rough. That was a rough era for film production. But I love how rough it is. And it's moving. It's one of the characters is adopted and they're asking all these questions about themselves. How can I find myself if I don't know where it came from? And I just love a film that asks questions and isn't always about all the answers.
Yeah.
This film is a huge question mark in the world.
And it being a road movies have a neat habit of allowing characters to sort of find pitching points to then ask the next question, almost, because you've completed a bit of the journey. It's which we do in life anyway, but you don't feel the earth move as quickly as you can in movie time, as it were.
Yeah, it starts with an ending. One of their characters' parents dies. And so you start at the end, and then they're just what's next for me? I don't know. cue road trip.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a genius classic narrative arc, but with like a culture that is not often filmed and not often like able to make their own films and tell their own stories. So in that way, it's, I feel like it has the spirit of Pump Up the Volume or something. It's like fun and revolutionary. It has fun rock music in it that keeps you going through these kind of like troubling scenarios. And you know, there's a lot of magic in that film that can never be lost.
I watched the trailer you sent over, and I like the look of it because it represents a time. I mean, it's weird if you think of like Danny Boyle's movie 28 Days Later is shot on DV, and in many ways it hasn't aged well, but in other ways it's aged perfectly because it is of a filmmaking time. And I'm guessing when Hooker by Crook was made, the DV was like the idea of having a Canon 5D is now, you know, the I can make a movie.
Yeah.
So therefore I can tell that story that isn't getting told.
Yeah, I'm sure they had like the top of the line DV camera at the time. I think the trailer makes it look worse than it is. I watched the trailer and I'm like, oof, I would not have cut this trailer for this film. But you know, everybody makes their own choices.
Well, it sold me certainly on the elements of it, of the kind of noir tones to it. That appealed. You know, the idea of the world isn't a level playing field, yeah. So we have to make it level. We have to break the law. You know, and then obviously, if we're not good at doing that, that's going to lead us into a different unlevel playing field. You know. Well, look, we've come to the end of your three films, so I thank you very much for sharing that. I thank you very much again for sharing with me some of your stories from making Even Hell Has Its Heroes. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the Britflix podcast.
Thanks for having me. You are a true pleasure to speak with.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.